In this 10th and final program from the second series of One of Our Own, Ivor Walsh was interviewed by Catherine Foley about his life as a writer and academic. Roseanne Foley recorded and edited the series, which is produced by On Corsicock. This was made with funding from Commissioner Na Mban and the television license fee.
Ivor Walsh, a Waterford man, was director of creative writing in the School of English in UCC. He was a lecturer there for 30 years. Sadly, Ivor died unexpectedly in July this year. When I met him in his office in January, he described first growing up with his brothers and sisters on the Folly in Waterford.
I have two brothers and two sisters.
And where do you come from?
I'm the middle of three boys, and then I have two younger sisters.
Really?
So I was born in 1962. I have a brother who's just a year older than me. And then my younger brother is about 7 years younger. Then my sisters are younger again.
So great fun when you were small, was it?
Yeah, we were, for a while, we were a family of two, and then the younger ones came along. So that was great because, you know, we always had, there was always a very good atmosphere from that point of view. And I always, if I think back on those times, as much as with anybody, everyone seemed to have a large amount of kids in their family. So you know what I mean? There was a lot of people of my own generation. And in the 60s, you know, people had four, five, six, seven kids. So we always had people our own age to go to school with, to play with and things like that.
We chatted on and Ivor spoke to me about his mother, Celine, and he explained how her family were the Hams of Ballybricken and originally from Germany.
My mum is still living in Waterford and she grew up in Waterford City. Her own family, her mother's family were a Waterford family for many years, but her father's family were German. She and her brothers and sisters and she also knew very well her own German grandfather. In fact, he came to Waterford and was living here, living in Waterford in the early part of the 20th century. He had come from Saxony, had moved to Liverpool and then finally came to Waterford. So both her mother and her father's family were in business in Waterford, and that's how they knew each other. And her mother was of a kind of a long-standing Waterford family. They were all involved in aspects of, you know, the meat trade. My grandfather had an abattoir, and then my grandmother's family were very much into buying and selling of livestock and the exporting of animals.
Ivor's father was John Walsh. He worked in St. Otteren's Psychiatric Hospital in the city, as his own father, Ivor's grandfather, had done before him.
My father came from Dunmore East and he grew up there. He actually went to school in Dungarvan, had good connections there. And his parents, my father's parents, met and married in St. Otteren's. So his father, my paternal grandfather, ended up being the chief nurse. Now, when he was working, they were known not as nurses, but as keepers. And it was a tough life. But they became qualified as and recognised as nurses. My paternal grandmother was also working there. And my father, who came to live and work in Waterford, and when he met my mother and got married, he worked as a civil servant all his life in the Department of Health. So he also worked in St. Otteren. So the place that his parents had met and married and had worked as nurses, he worked there in administration.
This was the psychiatric hospital.
Yes. Yeah. So when we lived quite near. So, I mean, one of the things I realised as a child was that, or sort of as an adult, that as a child, we had this unusual sort of access and kind of unfamiliarity with a very large psychiatric unit. As children, we're very much integrated into the life of the patients there.
So you remember some of the patients?
Oh, yes, because they were heavily medicated, so they could and did kind of lived very similar lives to ourselves. They wandered around town as kids do on a summer day. They bought comics and sweets and, you know, they kind of lived as adults sort of lives really very similar to those of kids. And we coexisted, you know, and looking back on it now, you know, we never thought about it. So I suppose because my father worked there, my grandparents had worked there, I knew the buildings very well. I'd go to see my dad in his office. The people who worked there were always very nice, the other staff or the matron or actually some of the patients who were working would always be very nice and welcoming to you. So it was quite an experience and I still walk past there. And I notice a big difference now with St. Otteren's is all the trees have been cut down and you can, there's much more access.
Mm.
When I was a kid, it was a much more enclosed world. It's a bigger world. I suppose the notion of a psychiatric hospital held no fear for me. And when I wrote my memoir, I called one chapter The Mental, which was what it was known as. And, you know, there was no sense of disrespect. It was just a kind of a familiarity as children did. But, you know, it thinking back on that now as an adult, like, I have very mixed feelings about the lives of the people who must have been there, because, you know, they were people who spend their entire adult lives in institutions.
Aver attended St. Declan's National School in the city, and he says he enjoyed his years there as a pupil.
My primary school was St. Declan's, next to the park in Waterford, and I remember I spent a lot of time looking out the window, which is, I wasn't the most attentive.
Were you not? You weren't a bookish kind?
No, I liked reading and I was well behaved, but I wasn't very good or very punctilious with my homework. And my brother was, my older brother was a year ahead of me. I think looking back on it, the thing I really remember about are the trees in the park, because they're so beautiful. And of course, I spent all my time looking out the window, supposed to be concentrating on my work. And particularly, I always remember April, May and June. And this still are, of course, the full beauty of the trees. And the setting of St. Declan's is so beautiful, as you know.
I was just going to say, up on a height, looking out over the park. It's such a lovely old-fashioned school too, isn't it?
As you know, you know it well.
Throughout the years of his childhood, Aver remembers attending the Theatre Royal. And he recalls the impact various productions had on him.
My other kind of huge memory was of Waterford, was the Theatre Royal, and going a lot when I was a kid. And
Failing a scholar.
Everything like that, and anything and everything. My mother had cousins who used to sing. They were lovely singers, and often they were in the pantos. Mm.
And then the light opera. I think the first festival of light opera was 1959.
Yes.
So that was just kicking off too.
Yes, and I think I went more as a teenager, but I remember the tops of the town, and people like the Waterford Glass or various places would put on. They were superb, I thought.
Like a lot of Catholic boys growing up in the 60s and 70s, Aver served as an altar boy.
The church I was an altar boy in was built, I saw it going up. It was in the Folly and where we were living, and it was the Church of the Sacred Heart. But it was built, we saw it going up. The old church was in a kind of a prefab next to the Ursuline Convent, so we used to go there. So the local parish were working very hard and they were fundraising, and they built these two very kind of modernist churches, St. Joseph and Danildis and Sacred Heart, and I was an altar boy in the Sacred Heart. Very big church is my memory of it, but as you remember, the stained glass was all very kind of modernistic and impressionistic, and it was built of concrete and everything like that. Turned out to be, I think, quite an interesting building. And I liked being an altar boy there. I liked the kind of, I liked showing off. And I have to say my experiences, particularly of the priests there, were very positive. And, you know, we all lived nearby and our families were all going to church, going to mass there. So everybody knew each other. You know, it was I think, a very safe community.
And is your Holy Communion then, does that stand out as a milestone in your childhood as well, Aver?
Yeah, it was good fun. It was nice. You got money and you got dressed up and everybody was nice to you. And I think my parents used to very kindly bring us to the Tower Hotel. And that was always, there was something called the grill room, which was something very big back in the 50s and 60s, where all the meat was being grilled. It was the height of sophistication. So I don't think kids would have been interested in stuff like that, but my parents would have had a nice grill and we would have had whatever, the kid menu. And we were treated very well. So I don't know if I was very religious.
Aver attended De La Salle College in Waterford for his second level education.
It's a big building. I think I was quite happy there. I wasn't sporty, so we weren't pushed to be sporty, if you'd want to be. I was interested in books. I was like debating, and we did radio. We used to do the radio, the school radio and things like that. So if you wanted to do things like that, there was a kind of a tolerance, I thought. Now, I think boys' education in those days, and I'm not sure if it's much better these days. I mean, when you're living in your own nice, comfortable home and everything is so, you know, my mother and father would have everything nice for us. School was a bit rough and ready physically. I think boys were kind of thrown into kind of big classrooms and whatever. But the atmosphere was always quite good. I have to say, I had a very positive memory of it.
And when did you start becoming more academic, more interested in learning and reading?
Well, that's a very good point, because I think all through school, I was a huge reader. And my parents are big readers, and I was never once stopped reading. So I was never told you can't read here, you can't read there, you can't read anywhere. You can read in the car.
Or you can't read this.
So, you know, people did keep an eye on what kids read. But I had the access to anything in the library. It was the old library on O'Connell Street. I remember taking out, not knowing what they were, I think I was about 14, and completely, just because I read a lot of history, Roger Casement's Black Diaries. Now, what they were doing there, I don't know. I don't know what to make of them. I didn't understand. And I was a bit bored by some of it now, looking back on it. But I think I was good at the subjects I liked, and I was no good at the subjects I didn't like. But I didn't make trouble. So I think when I realised that I could go, when I got to my Leaving Cert and I got to go to university to study English and history, from then on in, it was like I have spent the rest of my life in universities. And yeah. That's...
And where did you go to study?
I went to Dublin. So I did all my studies in Dublin.
In Trinity, was it?
In UCD. So I took time off in between and did a few things, but I kind of went back there again to do my PhD. And then I moved here to Cork in 91.
Yeah, I can't believe you've been here 30 years,
I know, I know. It's just a blink of an eye. What are we, 2024? So 33 years.
33
Life
years.
Of Christ. But so far, so good.
And you came first as a lecturer.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And Cork was very different back then. It was a lot smaller, a very nice department, very nice colleagues, and not very big classes of students. Mm. And then over the years, we've expanded and we've changed. And one of the things we've developed hugely is creative writing.
Eva recalls the 2015 referendum on same-sex marriage as a standout moment. Now, in your own private life, with that the referendum and the yes vote, did that make a difference to you?
Huge, huge difference.
Did you get married?
I didn't, no, but I could if I wanted to. Yeah, so yeah. That's good to know. And it's nice to know that you have that option.
Yes.
And I remember that day I was traveling, I was in Spain. In fact, I was in Portugal. I was doing some of the Camino, and I came back to vote, and I got back and everything. The airport was full, and I got down here to Cork, and it was a lovely, lovely day and everything. And I was just getting ready to go around and vote. And I bumped into my lovely neighbour who was still no longer with us, but a very elderly woman, lovely, lovely person. And she, a very strong and a very devout, practical Catholic in a good way. I admired her greatly for that, on her way to vote. And I was dying to ask her. I said, so what do you think? Oh, it'll definitely go through, she said. Oh, and I thought, well, I know what way she's voting.
Yeah.
And she was anxious to get around and vote.
There was a lovely feeling that the whole country were in agreement for
I think so.
In the right way. As a writer myself, I wanted to ask Eva about his own creative writing and find out how disciplined he is.
I suppose I learned early on, because that when I did my PhD, you have to sit down and write it. And so I got into the discipline of writing.
And I write when do you write?
In the mornings.
For how long?
Oh, I suppose if I could write from 9 till 1. Now, I might be doing other things and checking this and checking that. And this morning I was doing some editing rather than writing, but that's fine too. And then in the afternoons, if I do teaching or admin or all the correcting, anything I need to do, which is fine, and reading. But I suppose it's, for me now, it's a compulsion, and it's a necessary, it's like breathing or like having a cup of tea, or it's like it has to happen. There was a big struggle for me to get my first complete book out. I did a number of edited books, but the one that was the greatest struggle and the one I'm proudest of getting out, because there was a lot of difficulty with it, was I did a biography of the Limerick writer Kate O'Brien. And that was a very interesting process. It was a long process. But I went off and I met a lot of people who knew her.
And it was 2006.
Yes, but that was a good 10 years and it was difficult to get in print. And but that was a bit like going after a novel. I had to, you know, I went to England and various places and I met various people that knew her. And I was kind of in search of her.
And did you feel you found her in the end?
I think I did. I was very fortunate. John McGaughan came to Cork to do a reading and I was talking to him and he asked me what I was doing and I told him I was doing this. So he offered to read the manuscript and he read it and he said, it's not working. And he gave me 2 hours of really solid advice. Wow. And afterwards he wrote to me and he said, I hope I wasn't too hard on you. And I said, I welcome every bit of this. I think he was afraid he'd extinguished it, but I felt the opposite because he gave me a great example. She went to dinner with, Kate O'Brien was invited to dinner with someone, I think it was Evan Boland, and she said to Evan Boland, you know, I think the possession of a sense of humour is greatly overvalued. Mm. And he said to me, that's an interesting phrase. Get behind the woman who would say something like that. Mm. There's irony there. There's some real, that's quite sophisticated. Because like we all think a sense of humour is a great thing.
Yeah.
But for someone to say, well, actually, it's a bit overrated.
Yeah.
So what he basically said was get back and get the person.
When your memoir came out,
yes.
Did people most react to? I mean, it was warmly greeted and reviewed.
It was.
You know, people loved it. But tell me about the elements that people latched onto, especially.
Okay. I think that's a very good point. I wrote it and you're kind of a bit naive when you write something and then you publish it and then you don't know what people are going to make of it. I was quite negative about the Waterford of my childhood in terms of the physical environment. And I'd stand by that in the sense that I couldn't wait to get away. And I found it a kind of, now we're here on a fairly grim day in January. So that seems to me, every day seemed to be a bit like that. So there was always, to me, that sense of, I thought, a kind of dark, depressed city of the 60s and 70s. And getting to Dublin was an enormous kind of liberation for me. So I wrote about that. And that, I mean, I have to say, in Waterford's absolute, what's the word, defence, I remember speaking to a few people who read it, who were friends of mine, and they were saying, oh, but I love my city so much. And I said, well, this was my experience. And I talk about what it was like, and I wanted to get away.
Yeah.
I wanted to leave. But like when I left, I realised that it was still in me. It was still there. So people latched in on that. And I was very impressed with the fact that in the museum, there's the section, the Waterford, the brilliant section about Ballybricken and kind of the heart of the city and how it really is the centre of its history and politics and economy, that my piece about it was included. So I thought, well, you know, it wasn't very, you know, it was a bit of a dark portrait of a city as I experienced it. And it, you have to say a lot for a city that says, OK, we'll take that. And that's part of who we were. You know what I mean? So that was, I think a lot of people would have talked about that. The funny thing was that, of course, the other thing when I wanted to write it about growing up. I wanted to write about my city. I wanted to write about my grandmother, who's a big part of it. But I also wanted to write about the experience of being gay. And I felt there'd been, at that point, very few Irish books that had kind of dealt with that. So I kind of didn't want to talk. I just wanted to talk about the general sense of being apart and different and all of those things. And that's what I wanted to do. But I remember I wrote about like this idea of having, you know, falling in love or being attracted and that not knowing what was this about. But I remembered on the quay in Waterford, there was a men's clothes shop. And they had an ad in the front of it it was a picture of a very handsome model modelling nice underwear or something. And I remember, oh my God, this was like, but I was terrified to go past, but I'd had, you know, all this thing. And about 3 or 4 people told me that they had exactly the same experience. They remembered exactly that. They were fascinated, but they were terrified. And they think that everyone in Waterford was watching to see when they walked down the street, just to have like a quick look and then run away. You know what I mean?
And Ava, were you nervous when that was being published?
A little.
That was an aspect of the book that was going to be, that you were exploring and that was now kind of making public. Standing forth and saying who you are.
Exactly.
Was that a worry to you?
It was a concern, but I suppose a few things. I couldn't be fired. So that was a part of it. And I knew I wouldn't be. I knew the world I was working in and living in, that wouldn't be an issue at all. And I often think back at David Norris when he took his case back
in the 80s.
Like, David Norris could do it because he was working in Trinity, though he was in a place that he felt would support him, and they did, very much so. And, you know, also he was kind of independent in terms of, you know, his career and his life. And, you know, if you were working as a civil servant or working in particular areas or in some aspects of teaching, you know, there would have been times where you couldn't have done these things.
What year did it come out?
It came out in 2008.
Oh, so you were well established here.
Exactly. And I was very confident in that. And I already, in 1993, or 1997, I brought out a collection of essays on Irish lesbian and gay writers. And that was a bit of a kind of testing the waters for me. But don't forget, decriminalisation had happened in 1993. I had got my job here by then. I was very secure and very well supported by my colleagues and by students. I was already teaching a course on Irish lesbian and gay writing, which lots of students were taking. It was an elective, so people could choose to do it. Lots were interested in doing it. Lots of gay students, lots of straight students were interested in taking it. And then, you know, I kind of felt very secure in that way. That was part of my working life and one that was considered to be, you know, a good part of it. So when it came out, I was just a little bit nervous about that. But I also wanted to be very careful that I didn't speak or deal with anyone who wasn't me or my life. So you kind of feel a moral responsibility. It's not really the place. I think you have to be very careful how you write about people in your life when you're writing a memoir.
Yeah. Do you think, looking back on your childhood and people around you, can you remember other people who may have been gay?
Yes.
And that the pain they went through because they were living in those earlier times. I mean, we were talking about St. Otran's.
Yes.
Were some people in there, do you think, suffering mental illness because they were not allowed to express who they were?
Yes. And I think I was thinking a lot about that. I'm very privileged because when we teach so many great students, I'm learning a huge amount now at this part of my life, the older part of my life, about the different, how people, how they have different identities, not just gay, not just straight, but for example, I'm learning a lot through trans students, through non-binary students, and I had to learn, I'm learning.
And like we all are, I suppose.
Exactly, and I'm learning a lot by listening. And it's not the same for me, but it's parallel because you have people saying, oh, why is someone this, that, and the other? And I said, well, it's their decision, but I assume that back in the 40s, 50s and 60s, if you had an identity that wasn't this thing or that thing, or if you're neurodiverse in ways that we're now beginning to understand or, you know, work with, that's, you know, that in a sense, that's why the institutions were so big. In a sense, everyone.
Swept away.
A little bit. Now, you know, it wasn't the worst life. I was up close to it, but it was, you know, it was a relatively safe life. I would have known a lot of the nurses just through, there were a lot of them were neighbours and people around. But you lived your life medicated to a kind of childhood.
Aver has written 3 novels and 4 biographical books, as well as editing a number of literary publications. So I was curious to know what he is working on currently. Your current work, are you working on any either academic work or fiction or memoir?
Yeah.
What's coming out?
In terms of academic work, I've just published a biography of Jane Wilde, Esperanza, the mother of Oscar Wilde and wife of William Wilde, the poet and writer and activist. And I'm working with a fantastic author. We're also bringing out an edition of her poems. I've just finished, been working a long time on a novel which is in fact a lockdown novel based in a seaside village in Waterford, not named. So the two characters in a novel I finished, which I haven't published yet, they find themselves trapped in a seaside fishing village just outside, 10 miles outside Waterford. So I've gone back to Waterford, but not to Waterford itself.
What's it called?
It's tentatively titled The Girl from Hangman's Wood.
Oh, great title.
So we're hoping, and it is like a murder mystery. In fact, there is a Hangman's Wood there. I've been playing with another title. At the moment, it's called The Fictional Fishing Village of Nymph Hall. Yeah. So I kind of like, I've used that as well.
Towards the end of our conversation, I asked Eivor about his spiritual beliefs, and I asked him to share his thoughts with me on the afterlife.
So I don't have a sense at all of an afterlife for me. I don't. I had a dear friend and she was ill for a while and then she died, and we used to talk about that. And for her, she said, no, that wasn't what she saw. She didn't see herself as reuniting with people, or, you know. So that's not there for me. Maybe I'm naive or something. I don't worry about it. I should be worrying about it. It's not like it's getting nearer and nearer. Could be tomorrow, could be 20 years, you don't know. But I don't really have a sense of an afterlife. I suppose part of me hopes that my books will live on.
Yes.
But that's about it. And that's, I wouldn't be an unspiritual person. I wouldn't have a conventional religious belief. I would be open to it if it existed. I've walked the Camino many times and people often ask me, why do you do it? And I said, well, there's really good shoes in Spain, which there are, of course. So when you're finished, you can buy yourself a nice pair of shoes.
Eivor finished on a positive note when he spoke about his creative works and how he views them.
I also think when you're writing, you're controlling the whole world. You know, it's your place, it's your world. Now, whether it's any good or bad, you never find out. You have to work long and hard to get it, you know, to get it there. Whatever form that takes, our imagination allows us to have, to find whatever obsessions, and we all have obsessions, to kind of find worlds that we can live in, you know. So yeah, I would see it, it's an obsession and a compulsion.
Thank you very much, Eivor. It was really lovely to talk to you today.
Great.
Today, as Eivor wished, I know his books will live on. Er yeshteg reva anam usum.